Good afternoon. Welcome back. I call this Committee on Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. And before we move to the agenda for today, I just wanted to start with by welcoming our newest member in the Human Services Committee, Representative Vanik, welcome, and please join me in welcoming our newest member. We're going to be missing Representative Raya, who went to the other committee, but hopefully we will not forget her contributions. We also have a new committee legislative assistant, Fardosa Ahmed, and we also have our new page for today, Rachel Onsario. So thank you so much, and welcome. With that,
Mr. Chair, if I could just come in for a second, because Sean, I'm still in the committee, right? I don't have a name tag. I don't have a packet. I just want to make sure I wasn't kicked out. And
Representative Becca, we decided to kick you out of
I'm like, what's going on? So for the record, I'm still here. I'm recording that I'm sitting next to Don Gilman. I just want to make sure. So I just we'll figure it out. Thank you so much. No, so not a problem. Thanks.
We hear that you took your fold and everything with you. Maybe we thought you wanted to take it somewhere else.
Thank you.
With that, we start with the approval of the minutes. Representative Hicks, do you want to move the approval of minutes for March 30th, 2023?
Sure. So moved.
Representative Hicks moves the approval for minutes for March 30th, 2023. Any discussions? Hear none. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Seeing none, the minutes for March 30th, 2023 are now approved. With that, members, we are back, and we have important agenda items to go through. Our first agenda item is the update from direct care and treatment. As you all are aware of, we passed last session the separation of DCT from DHS. Wanted to welcome the Executive Director for Operations, Dan Stockham. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Stockham, Director of Operations Services for Direct Care and Treatment, and also the Incident Commander for the Incident Command Team around Direct Care and Treatment's creation project. So what we'll do today is walk through kind of the processes. The CEO, Marshall Smith, asked me to come to you and bring back concerns, but he's really looking forward to working with you through this session to move things forward here. I always like starting with what you passed last year. In Chapter 61, you created the Department of Direct Care and Treatment. You have it reporting to a board instead of reporting to a commissioner, more like other healthcare systems. Require that DCT bring back some legislation about that board and give details. You put in protections for the employees so during the transfer they don't lose in that process of just moving from one agency to the other. Same classification, same pay, and all of those aspects are taken care of. And January 1 effective date for 2025. I always like beginning these presentations with why are we even doing this? What's the benefit for having a separate direct care and treatment agency? And first of all, having a board with healthcare leaders means our whole healthcare system is being led by a board and somebody in the profession of healthcare in that process. Secondly, there's a clear distinction between DCT and DHS. DHS is the regulatory payment and policy side of things. DCT is the treatment side. So we have had some conflicts where they actually come in and regulate their own agency because they're regulating DCT in that process. So this eliminates some of those things. It preserves and reinforces our clinical aspects of our program in management of the patient care. We also had the ability to look across the system and bring to DHS and other organizations that continuum of care. Our clients don't just end up with us, we're kind of the tail end, but they also move back out into the community, so it's really that whole continuum we'll be looking at. And during COVID, we really realized that we need, as a healthcare system, to make some really quick, agile decisions because things and regulations change quickly, so that's what this would allow us to do. As part of your legislation, you actually created Department of Children, Youth, and Family. There was an implementation office that was put in place for that with a team of 10 or thereabouts that is creating that process, and they're looking at the creation of that organization. DC put together our incident command team, which is our exec team. And our exec team is actually the ones that are deciding moving forward. We used the same incident command process during COVID, and that actually was helpful to centralize decisions and make quick decisions and quick responses as things were coordinated because of the magnitude of what we're talking about here. While these two groups are working on the creation, we're also working with DHS on the transition and the moving things between the two organizations or between the organizations as we move forward. One of the things we've done is we actually have project managers assigned to ours, as well as DCYF, as well as DHS, and they are coordinating efforts to ensure as we move forward with things that we're all in alignment and coordinated as we kind of proceed. And one of the things for DCT in particular is that most of our staff are already in our budget. Therefore, we're not separating staff majority. Matter of fact, on the next slide, 98% of our staff today are currently in our budget. So they're not DHS that need to be transferred to DCT. They're actually part of DCT. And even the 2% for the service level agreement that we've got with DHS, two-thirds of those individuals already assigned to DCT and doing DCT work. These are the areas that we're talking about. Blue areas are our 24/7 operation at the top, the core services. None of those are changing. The bottom areas, all the support services, anything in blue we're already doing and providing our own resources. So we're really looking at those green areas saying, how do we separate those things out as we kind of move forward? DCT's language says January 1 of 25, we're going to be created as a new entity. We're proposing July 1 of 2025, and I need to apologize to Mr. Chair and the committee here. When we brought this forward, we were thinking only operationally, that operationally it aligns with the biennial budget. It aligns with our contracts that end June 30th, and that there's probably additional changes that need to be occurred before next. So I think there's some other conversations that need to go on, so we'll be looking forward to working with you and the committee on that as we kind of move forward. DCT took an approach of really delving into what needs to occur for us to be a new agency through three waves. The first wave is really looking at those five, six areas that we just talked about that have to be figured out where staff should be moved from and to. Second, in addition, there's some key things that need to be put in place for us to be a state agency as well that have to be looked at. The second wave is really things that we do coordination with DHS as well as other organizations. And the third wave is really looking at everything else, making sure we haven't missed anything in the process. Our goal is by July 1 of 24 to have a finalized action plan for 47 different groups. What that allows us to do is to know what needs to occur either in the following 6 months, if we do the January 1, or 12 months, and we'll be able to meet those timelines as we move forward. You have a handout that kind of has this picture. We figured it's pretty small on the screen here. These are our 47 different groups that are broken into three waves. Wave one is on the left side, and you can see that the first five, six areas there are talking about the different aspects of supporting DCT. Matter of fact, we're working directly with Minute, and we're going to be hiring a CBTO that will be specific for DCT, and we'll be working with that person directly on the creation and what's needed from the Minute side of things. The second work group is actually broken into four categories and prioritized by our incident command teams, so A, B, C, and D. And our last area, again, is all the other areas. I would like to point out that in the last area, one of the feedback we got from some of our stakeholders is, well, if you're going to have a group on vision, mission, and goals. What are you doing today? What are you trying to get to? And I'll talk about that at the end, kind of what we've got today and where we're going. As of today, half of our groups have met the goal of July 1 of 2025. We anticipate the other half will achieve that in the next 4 months. This is actually updated on a weekly basis by our project managers, and you'll see the notes in the key on the right side. If we see anything in yellow or red, that tells us there's an issue or a major issue, and that's where we then address those on a weekly basis as we kind of move forward. But looking good so far. Chapter 61 actually was created a new DCT chapter, which is 246C. The revisor actually creates that. It has actually in there today with the language from 61. But this body asks us to do two things. One, you asked the Reiser office to put together language to shift from all the different statute sections into this new section with no changes. And then you asked DCT to come forward and say, what should a board look like based on some general criteria, five-member board with certain criteria of who should be on that. That was all part of last year's, and we're going to be bringing that forward, coming forward. Excuse me. DC's proposal is going to have four major sections to it that we're going to bring forward. One is the change from January 1 to July 1, and we'll talk through that with the group here. The other is defining us as an agency and not a department. This is more a mechanical thing with the statutes. All departments have a commissioner, and since we're going to be reporting to a board, we figured it might be easier to put in chapter as an agency instead of a department, but that would really be what the advisor brings forward on that piece. We're going to bring forward the language that you requested about the board, and we've identified some there's additional things that need to be added because we are going to be the new agency, things DHS has had in the past or other agencies like a system account and some of those type of aspects that will be critical as we move forward. We put together this language and we gave it to the governor's office, but we asked the governor for special permission to talk to our stakeholders about it. So we put this in a format that we got with stakeholders. Matter of fact, before we even put together our language, we asked for three listening sessions with our stakeholders saying, tell us what you think should be part of this, tell us where your concerns are, and we developed our language around that. We then got special permission to send that out to all the areas so they had an opportunity to give us feedback on it. And then last Friday, we actually provided a response to the majority of the majority of the areas. The big area that we haven't finalized yet is the board itself. And there's a lot of questions about the makeup, who should be on it, and all of those things that I know the governor's office is working through right now as well. But hopefully we'll have that shortly to share with our stakeholders as well. And we update these stakeholder groups on a regular basis. Matter of fact, we were just talking with the tribal human service group this morning, giving them an update in the process and what we're doing. So we're really trying to get that more involvement of our stakeholders as even early on in the process here. Just to give you a sense of timelines and kind of what's next, again, this session we're looking for the passage of the revisor's bill as well as the DCT board and creation bill. In the interim, July 1 of 24, we will have our action plans finalized, ready to go and starting to implement. We're going to look for the governor to have the appointment of the board. And then that gives us time for that board to actually get up to speed in that process. And then working with the revisors on cleaning up terminology. You can imagine the terminology that's in the statutes over the last 20, 30, 40 years has changed for DC&T. And it'd be nice to have a consistent terminology. That's something we couldn't do this session because of the depth that we're talking about, but it's something that we would like to bring back next year. So next year, we'd be bringing back that cleanup language as well as any additional language in that process. And then if the July 1 date is the date that you choose, we're going to have the action plans completed, know exactly what we need to put in place or have in place for that transition. We go live as a state agency, and the board will take over as our authority, if you will. We also looked at the board itself and said, well, let's back this up. If we're going to do a July 1 time frame where we're going to have the first meeting, what do we need to do? 2 months prior to that, we're going to be looking at how do we prepare for the first meeting, the logistics, what type of equipment do we provide them? Is it a laptop or is it an iPad? Because remember, they're going to have critical client information and patient information here. So we got to think through all of those aspects. Backing up, we'd like to have them appointed by January or at least 6 months prior to the start of DCT so that they can do a site tour or site visits. They can do tours as well as we're working with the Minnesota Hospital Association and we're contracting with them to help us define what kind of training needs to be done so it's consistent with what other hospital and healthcare system boards are actually doing for their board members in that process. So we really want to bring this group up to speed about DCT and about what the board does and work with them as we kind of move forward. But that does mean then we're going to have to do the selection process later this year and through the Secretary of State's process. I mentioned the vision, mission, and values, the question from one of the stakeholders, and great question. DCT has a process in place that we are the backstop or the tail end of the system for Minnesota for a sex offender CD and mental health treatment, and that's not going to change today or tomorrow. We're still going to be doing many of those things. As a part of our strategic planning, we have five pillars of excellence that we're following today: quality, service, people, finance, and technology. Within those five areas, we actually every year get 90 plus of our professionals together to talk about, okay, where do we want to go next year with these goals? What's going to be the critical pieces? And when a new board comes on, they'll be a part of this process to help guide and direct us. But this year, we have 11 objectives, 15 strategies, and 33 metrics for DCT overall. Every core division also has several of them. Even support service areas have several that we are second layer down. But this gives you a sense that it's not that we're not doing anything. We have a direction. We know what needs to be done and how we're going to be measuring those things. But it's going to be when we become a new board or reporting to board, does the board want to revisit some of those aspects? So we're moving forward in that direction. What are our goals this year in particular? We're going to continue to focus on staff recruitment and staff retention. Like all healthcare systems, that is a key piece in a struggle that everybody's having right now. Thank you to this body for helping with the electronic health record this past year. We've got funding for that component, and that's going to be including telehealth, as well as implementing the comprehensive, integrated, and interoperability of that health record as we kind of move forward. Like all state agencies, we've got a financial stewardship component that we need to look at as we're moving forward. Is there ways that we can do things cheaper and better or faster in that process? Enhancing our partnership. I talked about all those meetings that we've been having with partners and the stakeholders here. We're going to continue to do that, and that'll be that foundation piece as we move into the new DCT model. We've also got our core four, which is our medical model and our process that we're actually utilizing as how to manage and treat patients and patient care and safety in the process. And then finally, we're working on the Malcolm Baldrige Award. We're in phase two right now. We got phase one application done 2 years ago. This year, they came in to a site visit. We actually got feedback from them. This is about continuous improvement. So you're improving your whole system as you move forward. And this is a national award. In 2 years, we're actually going to be going for that. Our whole commitment is we're going to go through the process because the process is what's going to improve our system. If we get the award, wonderful. But that's where we're kind of at in that process. So that's a very quick overview of where we are, where we're headed, and what's ahead of us here. So questions?
Thank you so much, Executive Director Stelkampo. Vice Chair, please go ahead.
Well, thank you for being here today. I probably would not get by without asking some questions. You and I are known to each other. In working with some of those ancillary programs that roll up under part of this, as you know, as a project manager, I am full of questions and much rigor, probably way more than you're used to. So I appreciate you having spent time to go in the weeds with me on that. But so a couple really high-level things that I wondered if we could touch on. First, just for folks in this room who are not project managers, could you kind of run through very quickly sort of and define for folks what an action plan is, what's included, and what it does, so that folks understand kind of where we're at?
Executive Director Stockham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner, and members, excellent question about project management in the process. We've actually got two project managers on board, and we've identified 47 work groups. We break each of those work groups down into having a leader, somebody from a logistics team, that would be the team that I've kind of helped focus and call paper pushers, and our project manager assigned. They meet and discuss and more brainstorm, okay, what needs to happen as we move into the new agency. They then put the actions down, what they're interested in doing or what needs to be done, and then they bring that back to our logistics team to review and to finalize. Now, action plans change because things change along the way, but what we're finalizing is the direction that they're trying to go and the items they're trying to get to in that process. I'll use Carrie Bjornis as the example here with legislative. EHS has always had the legislative process. DCT needs to create our legislative process or replicate what DHS has done. So she has 97 different tasks that she has to do before next legislative, et cetera, before we become our new agency. And then we're going to be tracking those items as we kind of move forward, saying, how are we getting done? Are they close to? That's why when I say July 1 of 24 is our anticipated date to have it finalized, we can actually say it, they've been finalized. And by July 1 of 25, we're going to track if we're missing anything in the action items in that process. And then we've got the dashboard here that's actually put together every week so that we're going to manage what's working, what's not working, or what's fallen behind in that process.
Vice Chair Bano.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sturkamp. Basically, I appreciate that we've outlined that really what we're doing is laying out what needs to happen, when, how do we split up the work, and how do we work together to meet the goals, right, on time. Correct. On time. So I appreciate that, and especially that you have already done some reporting in the dashboard here with weekly reports, so this is constantly being monitored, and there's tons of oversight to see that that is happening in the fashion it should. And then this is more of a broad question, but you know how I love barriers, right? Talking about barriers, that's my modus operandi. So I'm just curious, have you, as we've been working through this process of laying out what needs to be done and how we meet the goal on time, have you encountered any challenges or barriers in completing some of these action plans on time that you see down the pike, or as we're moving down the road, that might require some additional conversations or work to make sure that we stay on track?
Executive Director Stokum.
Mr. Chair, Representative and members, excellent question. There's actually a lot of those that come up along the weekly basis that we deal with at this level. But there are some that are going to be kicking up to you in particular with some of the language that we're going to be bringing forward in our bill to help ensure that we're meeting those aspects. In addition, we went to the governor's office and asked for special approval to bring forward legislation to get reviewed by partners. One of the big things the partner asked about, or for all of the partners, is who's going to be on this board, how big is the board going to be, and what is going to be a part of that. And that's where we have to work with our internal processes to come forward. But we'll bring a recommendation to this group to review and move. But we are listening to our partners in that process. So what you're going to see is there's going to be aspects they've asked for that will clearly be what we put in there in that process. So I would say it's at different levels, but all three of those levels are going to be important as we move forward.
Vice Chair.
Just finally, I just want to say thank you for you know, diving into the questions for me. And I appreciate that you do have teams on the ground swarming daily on the activities on this list. I should have been more clear. I was referring to the things that could, barriers that maybe could have legislative resolution. So thank you for that. And you also addressed that question as well. So I appreciate your candor.
Thank you.
Chair Pai.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, I'll try to think about the best way to put this question across. But the idea, you know, here's your audience, these people that, and the whole legislative body that created the work that you're doing right now, and we're very excited to hear the result. So that, you know, one thing that we're particularly interested in is, you know, we put something in statute and now you're executing it and you're giving a description of that. And I guess we want to keep raising up, like, what should we be aware of when we ask for something like this to happen, to make sure what we write in statute is, you know, sufficiently described and funded and is matching real world expectations. And then also maybe even to talk a little bit about the particular nature of this, which is here we are giving direct care. And that's not what we usually do in state government, give direct care. But, you know, there's grants and, you know, all the work. But like, comparing it to education, I mean, we send money to school districts, and they're the ones that do the direct education. We don't. But this is one where there are physicians and nursing assistants that are hands-on with folks out there. And how are those people impacted at that level is one thing I'd like to know on, based on the structure of the organization is changing around them. And are they involved in this process? Is this a burden on our already critically burdened healthcare systems out there? And timelines and things like that, is that all working? And, you know, what should we know? And also we're just, you know, very gratified to hear about the progress that you're making right now And you know, lots of green, and it turns out that black one at the end is a good thing, so thank you for that. And we want to see the next one with even more black squares all filled in. So there is kind of a general question, and there's things that you can address now or, you know, at some point follow up and give us a after action report about how this went and what we should know for the future.
Executive Director Stockham, if you can also remind us how many patients do we serve in that same question, and then also how many staff members will be moving, you know, technically from DHS to be only DCT.
Mr. Chair, Representative Breyer, as well as other members, that was a lot of questions. Let me start by saying we are as excited about you in this endeavor. This is an opportunity for us to carve out direct care and treatment, and like you said, patient and patient care, and have that kind of central and at the forefront for this group as well as our board as we move forward with things and talk about it. We are a government agency providing treatment. That is unique. And in doing so, that does create challenges that I think all of us are going to have to get together to work through from time to time. Ms. Chair, to your question on the number of staff, we have approximately 5,000 staff of the 7,500 in DHS. We have roughly 11,000 to 12,000 clients every year. Some of those on any given day, we got about 1,500, 2,000 that are inpatient, getting treatment in a secure environment. Remind this group, we are a 24/7 operation, 7 days a week. It doesn't, we're like casinos, we're always open and moving forward with things. So we need to have structures in place to do all those aspects. The staff themselves. Matter of fact, I'll be presenting to the forensics managers and supervisors this afternoon and talking to them about kind of what we're doing and where we're going. What they're doing today, they're going to do tomorrow. And what they're doing tomorrow, they're also going to do under the new board. If anything, there may be 5% change overall, but the reality is our staff aren't going to be impacted by this directly. Matter of fact, if there are people that are moving to DCT that used to report to DHS, you actually put protections into the last statute that allows them to make that transfer without losing anything in that process. Seniority, classification, pay, range, all those type of things will continue with that. So we're going to watch that real closely. But again, we're going to have a small number of that, of those cases in DCT. And there may be some other opportunities for others as we reposition positions around the organization to really accomplish what DHS has been providing for us in the past. But we don't anticipate any significant number more staff because of what we're doing. We've got the majority that are already within our budget. I hope I covered somewhat of your questions.
Any member questions? See none. I think we have a lot of work to do and more conversation in terms of the timelines and everything else. I just wanted to thank you and your team for actually getting us close to the finish line. So looking forward to more conversation and assuming the bill is ready to official to go for the codification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I've got the jackets on in front of me right now. So I'd like to get those signed and dropped before the day is over.
Amazing. So anybody who is interested, please see Chair Fisher. So thank you so
Mr.
much.
Chair, members, thank you very much. We look forward to working with you over the next 2 years to implement and to see and help guide this direction of our organization. But thank you for what you've done, and thank you for the offer to bring things back, because we will as we need them. Thanks.
Thanks. So the next on the agenda is Department of Human Services update on nursing facilities. Welcome to the Committee Assistant Commissioner Mutz and Director Cook. So please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, representatives, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Natasha Mers, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for Aging and Disability Services here at the Department of Human Services. And I will turn it over to Director Cook.
Good afternoon. My name is Valerie Cook. I'm the Division Director for Nursing Facility Rates and Policy at the Department of Human Services.
And Mr. Chair and representatives and members, thank you again for having us here. Before I turn it over to Director Cook, I'm pleased to be here so we can present information and updates on nursing facilities in Minnesota, including where and how people are choosing to receive services, how they're paying for it, updates on rates and trends we're seeing in wages and related topics on nursing homes. We're also pleased to provide updates on the implementation of the substantial legislative package from the 2023 session and share what we've accomplished and what we're working on. So with that, I'll hand it over to Val.
Thank you. Chair Noor and members of the committee, I'm going to, as Natasha said, share some data with you. Well, as soon as we get this running, there we go. To start with, I just want to talk about how the nursing home industry has been shrinking in size for many years, and I think as you all know. And the purpose of this data that I'm sharing here is the green line is showing the tremendous growth that is happening where older adults and people with disabilities services are receiving their services in home and community-based settings, and we're now looking at up to over 90%. The blue line is representing the decline in utilization, decline in total days in nursing facilities, and so we're continuing to see this separation. With this data here, that's just breaking down, you know, that same nursing facility decline in utilization by payer sources, and you'll notice the private pay in the green line is the biggest drop in nursing home utilization is about 40%. This could be a reflection in consumer choices. They're, you know, choosing other settings in the community instead of nursing facilities. The next largest decline we see is the bottom blue line, which is Medicare. So I think that what we're seeing here with that decline is that there are fewer and fewer Medicare paid days in nursing facility, and I think what's happening is that particularly through Advantage plans, that folks are leaving the hospital and going directly home with support services at home and bypassing the nursing facility in that process. And you can see the top line is the Medicaid utilization, and there is also a decline there of 23%. So I just these are kind of interesting trends, and like I said, we can't explain it all, but I think it is a combination of consumer choice, options in the community, and other trends. We're all familiar with VBR, which was a new reimbursement system for nursing facilities that went into effect on January 1st of 2016. And what we're demonstrating here is there are very positive features of a cost-based system like that. And you can see here that since the beginning of VBR, the daily per diem rates have nearly doubled in the last 9 years. And so this is a tremendous growth in the cost of nursing home services, which could also be contributing to what you're seeing as part as consumer choices. I also just very briefly want to touch on, there was a lot of, I guess I'll call it administrative chaos during the COVID pandemic. There was discussions about, you know, the department being off on their audit cycles, late publication of rates, et cetera. And the good news is we are back on a normal timeline. This year, all the nursing facilities got their published rate on time last November 15th. And it feels good to just say we are back on a normal cycle of processing and producing VBR rates. To touch briefly on the forecast, one of the features of VBR, as you know, is that cost increases are incurred by nursing facilities. There is an 18 to 24-month delay before you see it in the reimbursement rates that follow. But in effect, there is that creates an already existing inflationary factor that occurs under the VBR the way it's currently designed. I just wanted to point out that the November forecast projects there's an additional $250 million in additional spending in the forecast for fiscal years 25-26 four nursing facilities under just the existing VBR design. There's a second component of that. There's an additional $70 million in the forecast for that temporary rate adjustment that was approved last session of $12.35 per day that went into effect July 1st of 2023, and that will expire at the end of this year, December 2024. So that is accounting for an additional $70 million. One of the positive features of VBR is the way it was designed to be cost-based in care-related costs, and you'll see, and that was intended to create an incentive to raise wages and invest in nursing facility staff. Again, here is to show you a trend of what's happening to wages in nursing facilities since VBR was implemented. And you can also see here quite a tremendous amount of growth. The one thing I want to caution about this data is this is not hourly rate, hourly average hourly wage rates. This is average hourly compensation. In other words, what is it that the nursing facility, what is it costing the nursing facility per hour? And the reason that is different is because our data includes shift differentials, for instance, to work second and third shift. It includes overtime, cost of overtime, and we don't have enough the specificity in our data to be able to break down what exactly our average hourly rate. So I just wanted to put out that caution. We all are aware of the staffing challenges that in long-term care and other settings, and this is some data to share about what's happened. What you will see some pretty significant changes that happened with the workforce through the COVID pandemic years, and the blue line is to show that there is a lower rate of staff retention in the last couple of years. And really what I wanted to demonstrate with this data is the green bars are showing the increase in using temporary staff or agency staff, pool staff that you'll want to call it. So that is quite a significant increase in use of those temporary staff, which along with that is increasing costs because they are paid up to 150% more per hour than employed wages. So that is one trend. I should point out, you know, this is 2022 data. The 2023 data just is coming into the department now. Those cost reports are just due here in February. And so this data is a year old. So I just want to point that out as well. To just provide briefly some updates on implementation of the funding that was provided to nursing facilities late last 2023 session. I already mentioned the temporary rate add-on of $12.35 per day that was put in place on time for facilities rates. That applies to both the private pay folks and Medicaid rates. The second item here is the $173 million cash lump sum payments that were to be delivered August 1st of 2023 and August 1st of 2024. Those funds do not impact the daily per diem rate. They were to be used for helping with expenses that are outside of the VBR rate. So the first payment did go out on time on August 1st. And the total payment to facilities ranges from $280,000 to $1.5 million. The money was distributed on a formula based on active beds, which, you know, so of course the largest facility received the most money at $1.5 million. I'll briefly touch on the workforce incentive grant, and my next slide has a little more detail about that. That was, again, state-funded money that will not impact the daily payment rates. And eligible workers in nursing facilities were able to receive up to a $3,000 incentive payment, provided they were making $30 an hour or less. The funding was distributed to nursing facilities earlier this fall in October of 2023. And I will break that down in just a moment. And lastly, there was the $100 million investment in the financially distressed loan program, which I'll talk briefly about in a moment. So yeah, we'll move forward. A little more details about the workforce incentive grant program. 321 nursing facilities applied for these funds. There were, I believe, 14 nursing facilities that did not apply for the funds. All 321 of these facilities did receive grant funds for their employees. And the total amount that was requested in those applications exceeded the total appropriation quite significantly. So what we had to do was we created a formula to equitably distribute the appropriation among the facilities that applied for the funds. And basically what we did is the application included all the employee names that were eligible for this money, and we distributed it accordingly. And so we, each facility that applied received funding of $2,840 per employee, but that did not preclude them from distributing it in a different manner, like up to 3,000 for a full-time employee, for instance, something less for a part-time. The facility still had the option to post a distribution plan and describe to their employees how they were going to distribute those funds. Given that the language was set up that we could do more than one round, but we did distribute the entire appropriation in this first round, so we will not be issuing applications again. The loan program. This is the last of the initiatives from last session that we're working on standing up. I have to say that this is something very new that we've never done. This is far more complex. What we did is, I'll step back. So the idea of this program, at least in my head, was to provide assistance to nursing facilities with that gap that you hear about under VBR. They incur cost expenses, they have a hard time with their cash flow until they get it back in their rates up to 2 years later. And so this seemed to be a mechanism to help with those cash flow problems. These loans are interest-free. If they receive a loan, they get this payment, and they do not have to start their repayment to us until 18 months after they've received the funds, and they have up to 6 months to repay them. And we would be setting that up on a monthly in repayment installment plan. What we did is we published an intent to apply form, sort of like a request for information to help us understand what the scope of this interest was and what the scope of this problem was. I felt like that was a very informative process for us, because now, you know, we understand kind of what people have in mind, how they intend to use the loans. Does it fit with what we understood the intention of the legislation was? So we can further refine the final application, in which we hope to get published by the end of this month. It also gave us some idea of a volume, so as we operationalize this with our financial operations division, and figure out how we're, you know, because we have to set up accounts and then, of course, you know, distribute the money and take back in the payments. So this is kind of a different process than we're used to. So we're working through those details. We hope to have the first loan funds dispersed, you know, into April sometime, early May. We did get 73 intent to apply forms that were valued at $109 million. I think submitting an intent to apply form did not create an obligation necessarily that they would actually follow through with an application. And if somebody did not submit an intent to apply form, they're still eligible to apply for the loan when the final form is out. So, you know, it gives us an idea. The final result is still yet to be determined. Lastly, I'll talk about the Critical Access Nursing Facility Program. This is a program that we had in place prior to when VBR was put in, established. What this program did, the first version of this, is geographically isolated rural nursing facilities had an opportunity to get an extra rate bump. And the idea being we use data about their actual costs to bring them closer to a cost-based reimbursement. When we went into VBR, everybody transferred to a cost-based reimbursement. So the way this was designed did not really work. We reconstituted how the program was set up. When it was actually a pretty modest investment, we were able to bring in 20 nursing facilities to receive this assistance. And that, again, was a program that was effective July 1st, 2023. There were staggered starts to this program as we waited for federal approval and as we waited for private pay notifications to be given, because these rate increases will also affect private pay. The greatest rate increase under this program was up to $40 per day, but there was a variance, of course, based on the applications that were provided. What's next on the horizon? I just want to touch on some federal and state initiatives that kind of align with each other. The federal CMS has published a final rule about transparency in nursing home ownership, and so there will be beefing up all of the disclosure that needs to go into when you apply for a license, when you have a change of ownership, and there will be more disclosure about the organizations that are purchasing these nursing facilities. Along with that, we are advancing a proposed policy bill this session that would also ask for operators to disclose, have more transparency in their financial transition, particularly transactions with related party organizations. And we are also asking for operators to disclose how much they're paying for their real property through leases or rents, whether it's related party, independent party. This is a part of an operation that we don't have enough information. There are often information that's shared that this industry is under severe financial stress. And we are often asked for what is our assessment with all the data that we have. We have great data on operating expenses, but we don't have the full picture. And we cannot either affirm that financial distress or challenge that financial distress with data. And so this purpose of this language is for us, it's for information only. It doesn't change anything about how rates are set or anything like that. It is just about helping us to have a better opportunity to understand the financial status of Minnesota's nursing homes. I think one more thing. I'll try not to belabor. There is another big thing that's happening that's being driven by action at the federal level is nursing facility daily payment rates are set on a resident assessment that's designed and mandated by the federal government. We've aligned our case mix payment system to do that. The federal government has changed that assessment, and they have changed how they're going to pay for Medicare days. Consequently, we have to change as well. And so we have been working on this. The federal government will no longer be supporting what we need to set our current case mix rates, payments rates. And so we have implemented an optional state assessment, which is a temporary short additional assessment information that CMS is still continuing to support states with, but that support will end October 1st of 2025. So we will need to do something to adjust to the new federal system, and our plan is to bring that proposal and that transition plan to you all in the 2025 session. We do have a contractor on board that's an expert in this topic that is helping with us, and we're continuing to work with stakeholders, and we'll have that fully fleshed out for 2025. That is the end of it. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you so much, Derek Cook and Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your second slide, we have got the percentage decreases and the different payers. I see there's an increase in other. Is that the portion of transition from hospital to home for other patients?
Other is going to include days from like the veterans system. It will also include what we call dual eligibles that are in a managed care plan where they're eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. And enrolled in those programs. I would say that that's the primary amount of those days. Those days would also include if somebody has private long-term care insurance.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you've got private pay down, so I thought that was the assumption that that's where the private would be covered. No, what I'm interested in is there's a huge issue with hospitals being able to, they've got people that don't need the level of care in of a hospital, but they don't have a place to go because they need some care greater than what they would have at home. And therefore, there are some nursing homes, senior care facilities that have beds or sections that are occupied by people that are coming out of the hospital, spending a few days or a few weeks before going and staying at home. I'm trying to understand how that data is presented in your reports, because in many parts of the state, there are issues with the hospitals and capacity. There are also issues with trying to find a facility for, you know, an older parent or someone that needs that care. There's just not capacity in many of these facilities. And so when I see all of this, it doesn't answer some of the key questions about what is the occupancy rates, what is the mixture of occupancy for the different categories, and what is the interaction between the hospitals, these facilities, and is there a gap for other facilities? I see all the decrease in hours, in days, which, and I know that there are multiple facilities that have closed over the years. So we've got a maximum capacity in our state that appears like it probably is lower. And so all of these factors, if we have the data and information, we can maybe understand and come up with proposals to help alleviate some of the issues relational to these facilities.
Representative Quam, I think you asked a couple of questions in there. So I just wanted to start with we created a task force for the acute care transition. We're going to get a report on that so we can figure out how we can address that issue. I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Maas, you wanted to take that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, thank you for that question. And we are also very concerned about and closely working on the issue of people that are overstaying in hospitals and not able to discharge to the appropriate level of care, whether that's a nursing home or directly into the community. So I think what's important to understand about this data is it's a representation of the payments that are going out through the Medicaid system. It's not going to give us a full picture of the state of kind of long-term care in general, but I think it does give you a good sense of what consumer choice is. You know, as we've talked with operators of nursing homes about what is contributing to their inability to admit people directly from the hospital, there are several factors that are, or themes that are coming up. One of them is feeling like they can't take the financial risk if someone is MA pending, so we think they might be eligible for Medicaid for long-term care, but we don't, they're not actually on it, or maybe they have a spend down, as well as sort of decision-making issues related to supportive decision-making and who's helping that resident make choices. So I think that, you know, as Representative Nora, as you rightly point out, we do have an acute care transitions advisory council that will be producing a report in 2025 ahead of session and hope to dig in and get, you know, even deeper into some of those issues in terms of what is specific to prevention of nursing home admissions from this sector.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that group that's looking into it, I know the Mayo Healthcare System and Sanford and others are actually placing people in neighboring states where they have some excess capacity. And we might want to look and see what they're doing that allows them to be able to function and have that excess capacity. But I had one quick clarification.
Can we just get a clarification on that? I think Director Cook can help us address people being transferred to outside the state.
Chair Norr, Representative Guam, I don't believe that I have statistics about how many people, particularly if they're not Medicaid, if it, you know, if they are private pay or Medicare. I do know that we get occasionally an inquiry from an out-of-state provider, Iowa, Wisconsin, a border type, seeking to enroll in our Medicaid program, but I don't have any data that would support that there is a lot of that going on, at least in the Medicaid program.
Representative Fong.
Thank you for that. And Mr. Chair, again, you mentioned we've got a group that's looking at it. I just want to make sure that we don't overlook some useful data. Clarification on your sixth slide of where you have it, care hourly salaries. I'm used to salary, you know, like hourly rate, but salary would be non-overtime. You've got nurse administrators listed there. Is this a mixture of both salaried positions and hourly?
Director Cook.
Chair Norr, Representative Guan, I would say that primarily this data is based on paid hourly staff. Nursing administration could be a salary type person, and this data wouldn't make a distinction between the two. But we do, even if it's a salaried position, we do collect the total hours worked. And so I believe that this would be comparable by these various positions without necessarily breaking out whether it's salaried or. I would say most everybody outside of the nursing administrative category would be on an hourly basis.
Representative Crump, you good? Representative Gilman.
All right, thank you, Chair. So just wanted clarification. Did you say, so there was a bump in payments, you know, that residents would have to make that were private pay this year, and then there's also going to be another one next year as well? And you said up to $40 a day more. Is that correct?
Director Cook.
I think it was on, what slide, page 12, maybe?
Chair Norr, Representative, yeah, I think you're referring to the critical access facilities. And so there were a couple of programs I talked about today that would impact private pay rates. One is that $12.35, that's a temporary rate for 18 months. That is included in their rate. The other one is the critical access nursing facility. I believe the range from that for that program for facilities participating was somewhere about $8 per day to a maximum of $40 per day, but you are correct about that.
And that one will...
Representative Gilman.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Chair. I'm just getting back into the swing of this. That will come into effect after 18 months, that next phase, or it will all be happening now?
Turn to our representative. They're at the same time. Both of them are temporary. So the critical access nursing facility program is also designed to that rate increase to last for 2 years. We will then open it up for applications again. The same facility could apply again and continue a payment for another 2 years. But they're both temporary. But they can occur at the same time.
So the critical access nursing facilities is up to $10 million, as I understand, with the base that is already in there. And the additional funding that we did was the $3.9 million. Is that correct?
Chair Norr, if I'm recalling what was already in the base, I think it was about $3 or $4 million that was in the base. This investment is on top of that. You're correct.
And the temporary rate increase goes up to close to $134 million because of the private pay and other pay that we ended up approving. I'm assuming that's the additional funds that come with the investment that we made.
Chair Norr, you're correct. With the temporary, I think the value that's shown here in the $51 million is the Medicaid value. But with the private pay contribution, usually that does convert into about, I would say, just off the top of my head, close to 80 million, 85 million.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Representative Zelesnicker.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I can't see you, but thank you for your presentation. My my questions are just thoughts on this. Is on the slide where it's showing the 2001, the population change between the long-term care facilities and waivers and home cares, I think that's exactly what we saw. Is we built assisted livings and home care and a lot of community-based programs across the state. And that's exactly when I entered after being a nursing home administrator for 10 years was 2001 at one of the first ones in Duluth. And as that's happened, that rate was based on a modified version for home community home-based services on a modified version of the case mix rate that we used to have at that time, 75% to save money for the state. It was to move people that didn't need to be in nursing homes out. And while we've done that, when you look at the grid that shows costs, you know, from the nursing facility for skilled nursing home, what it costs for the rate from 2015 to 2024, the rates have went up, and simultaneously the rates have went up in the community-based market too, because the care needs for the population that have moved out of the nursing home are also advancing. And so we have rate tools that are evaluated by the counties to determine for the medical assistance population on if their needs have changed. And as they're aging, they are changing, so those rates are reflective of the care they need, and that's moved up. And so, and the assisted livings have now mirrored the regulatory compliance that we used to have in the nursing home, which that's the interesting thing to me when I look at this data, is that we created a new model in 2001 for the assisted livings because we had so much pushback on the issues that were facing nursing homes. And in reality, we are creating another model of the nursing home and the assisted living compliance. And those rates are mirroring now what used to be the nursing home rate because the mandates are so significant that the costs are there. And when I look at the cost for the nursing homes, while it's went up 8%, 10%, you know, in those rate years going up, that's during the COVID time, 22, you know, year 22, 21, those, and it correlates to the use of the agency staff for facilities, which of course was in that VBR rate too. And so those fixed costs that are in there from, you know, when you look at the fixed costs for facilities that run 24 hours a day, whether it's direct care treatment centers or the facility in Moose Lake or these, they have food, heat, utilities, property taxes, insurances, and wages that have went up higher than, you know, we would probably like. But the reality is the costs are being reimbursed for costs that were paid. And so with the, I appreciate that the audits for the nursing homes were done timely because they are working on a retrospective rate. So when the audits were done now for the nursing homes for this 2024 rate, that 36104 reimbursement rate for the nursing homes is really reflective of costs that occurred from about 2022 or a little bit later, correct?
Director Cook. I know the
Chair Noir, Representative Zelenskar. That is correct. The January 1st, 2024 rate is based on costs that occurred in 2022.
Representative.
So, thank you, Chair Noir. Thank you. So the issue facing the industry continues to be the gap, and that is why that $300 million was so critical. I have talked to some of the facilities that have closed since we left session in 2023, and the one that I talked to recently said they had no choice but to close. The hospital would have been in jeopardy if they would not have closed the nursing home because they would continue to operate with a $1 to $2 million loss. And that was with getting the $225,000. While they appreciated that, they knew there was no long-term sustaining thing besides isolated payments like in year one and year two. And it would not sustain the $1 to $2 million loss and the hospital would be in jeopardy. And so when I look at this, you know, the rate for nursing home care is high, but in perspective to what it costs to stay in a hotel a night with no services and no labor costs, it's really not. When you look at what it costs to be at Moose Lake for MSLP. I believe it's over $400 for a day of care. And you look at the care that's provided to the frailest of the frail, that care level is under what it costs for us to do the treatment center. And those costs are just absolute costs from our wage intentions of paying people over $20 an hour for the highest care, when the reality is you can make $19 to give me a cone when I go through McDonald's to get my coffee. And so we have a big gap here that's not going away. And so I appreciate that the audit's been done timely, but the nursing homes are going to continue. And my concern is that we have a work group that deals with this, because we are not going to be prepared. The number of people that are going to be on medical assistance is clear by this. The private pay line is going down, the medical assistance going up. And so how we encourage people to save their assets or do incentives for people, I think it's going to be critical. And having at least the timely audit report was helpful, because the nursing homes have that rate by 2024. But I think it's critical that this committee remembers that they're not working with an inflation rate built in. And we created inflation rates built in other aspects for education, but healthcare is not working in that model. So it is going to always be a catch-up gap. And how we do that, I think, is going to take some tweaking. But thank you for getting the audits out timely, because I know that was really critical to the facilities. And we have a lot of work to do. But I thank you for the data.
Thank you. I don't know if Assistant Commissioner to respond quickly or Director Cook.
Chair, Representative Zalesnikar, just the only quick response I would have is, one thing we didn't cover in this presentation is we do have a rate study that's looking at VBR and some of the issues that you raised that we'll be submitting to the legislature. I can't remember the date off the top of my head. Director Cook.
It's coming.
Chair Noor.
Yes. It's next year.
The rate study is due in early 2025. And so we will be working on that. I think one other thing I would like to mention, you talked about the cost increases during the COVID years, and I agree that the way VBR is designed was particularly challenging. But I would also like to point out that post-COVID, we're settling into a similar healthcare inflation. And so when you see the 7.3% and that 3.7, part of that is that reflection of that temporary rate. If you were to take away that temporary rate, you're actually seeing the cost increases settle into more of a 4 to 5%, which is much more manageable than 10, 12, 15% in cost increases that occurred because of the COVID pandemic.
Yeah. Thank you. The next representative is Kayla.
Thank you. I'll be real quick. Page 10 is what I'm looking at. My question is more of a yes or no question. In the formula that you use to apply what you call equitable distribution, do you take into consideration workforce shortage areas and geographic spread?
Is that for Director Cook?
Chair Noor, Representative, we did not. We just took straightforward the numbers of employees that were listed on the applications and distributed the funds accordingly.
So my quick follow-up for that is, it's really great to have maps. I'm a greater Minnesota member with border city issues, and that's a big workforce shortage area. And so when you come back and you distribute all of the money, in my mind, and I think in others, it would be really nice to know where geographically that goes, whether it's by a map actually showing us or some sort of confirmation that when we look at money going out the door, it's more than just saying we're giving it to the people that applied, but that it's equitable geographically, border to border in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any closing remarks, Assistant Commissioner Director Cook?
Chair Noor, nothing from me.
Chair Noor, nothing else.
Thank you so much. I think we'll have more conversation on the loan program and others, because they need to make it more a little bit flexible, and to also remove the deadline, which is the 2029, so we can have a revolving loan program. So we'll have more conversation, and I'm also interested in the transparency in nursing facilities, so we will discuss that during this session. So thank you so much. Appreciate it. And now we'll have a presentation from the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. Ms. Henin and Rudina, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Honorable Chair Knorr and Honorable Committee members. I am Cheryl Henin, the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman.
Parise Rudina, Legislative Specialist, Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today to your committee. The focus of my testimony today is on the resident. It is an honor. It is my duty to represent people who receive long-term care services and supports in long-term care settings and in their own homes. My testimony today includes actual resident stories that inform our policy considerations. This picture, So Why We Serve. The gentleman on this picture was a client of one of my regional ombudsman staff. He received a bill from a provider substantially increased from the previous. He was given no explanation from staff of the assisted living. This man wrote this note to the regional ombudsman, distressed that he did not know where to turn, anxious, distressed, extremely worried. And actually the result with our office being involved was a very good result. But I share this with you to give you an idea of the wonderful people that live within all of your communities that are receiving long-term care services. Many people today are concerned of the high cost of long-term care. In fact, just yesterday, someone contacted me to find out about why such high cost. How long will their funds last? Will they outlive the funding they have? And wonderment of where does the money go? The number of Americans age 65 and older is projected to reach 95 million by 2060. The beauty is our older adult population is incredibly diverse. The share of the older population that is white is projected to drop from 77% to 55%. Respecting and embracing ethnic and cultural diversity within our communities protects all people against elder abuse and helps us live up to our national ideal of justice for all. This slide is our mission and visions, our mission statement and our vision statement for your pleasure to read. The next slide is our legal authority. So the legal authority for the Ombudsman Program for Long-Term Care is established in federal law, the Older Americans Act, as well as federal regulation, as well as Minnesota statute. Every state must have a state ombudsman for long-term care working full-time in a program. That goes along with that, of course. The governing structure for my office, or who I report to, is the Minnesota Board on Aging, a 25-member governor-appointed board. Each state must name or identify a state unit on aging, and in Minnesota, it is the Minnesota Board on Aging. Our locations, central office right here in St. Paul, regional offices throughout Minnesota, and our team includes wonderful trained certified ombudsman volunteers statewide. I want you to, I'm turning to the handouts that you have. One is our brochure. The other, you have four maps, 2019 and current. And the reason that I bring these before you today is for you to see, back in 2019, many of you, hopefully, all of you, supported a budget appropriation for our office. I committed at that time that most of the funding that would come to the program would be invested back into the communities by adding regional ombudsmen, which means the addition of regional ombudsmen allows for more access to people seeing advocates. So I wanted you to see a visual of where we were in 2019. Every number represents a staff person with the carve out of the metro. So I'm proud to say and very grateful that the appropriation in 2019 and the one last session is being put to good use. Thank you. So who contacts us? The federal government requires that we issue a report every year. And the elements that are to be reported, this is one of them. Who contacts us? So this slide identifies complainant types, which means who is it that is contacting the office. The highest percentage, and I am proud of this percentage, is 37% are from residents, 31% from family, friends, spouses, and others, and 15% from facility staff. That is an increase of 25% from last federal fiscal year. I am proud of the fact that the percentage of staff contacting our office has increased. What does that do? That shows us that we're working to build trust and working together to solve concerns, not divided. The next slide is our complaints. So this gives you the type of facility, and you will see blue is nursing facility, green is residential care communities, assisted livings. The blue, the other, would be adult foster homes, people receiving hospice care, people receiving home care. The complaints, so the title of the complaints, that's driven by the federal government. Admission, transfer, discharge is just that. Admission, transfer, or eviction, we've had an increase in that area. Autonomy, choice, or rights, and quality of care. The interesting fact here is the same three complaints were the top complaints last year, federal fiscal year 2022. So looking at admission, transfer, discharges, and assisted livings, the increase can be attributed to requirements in the assisted living licensure law that was passed. The good news I want to point out is the use of a provision in the licensure law, prerequisite to termination of a contract. Before issuing a notice of termination of a contract, the assisted living must schedule and participate in a meeting with the resident and the resident's representative, and this meeting needs to take place at least 7 days before a notice of termination is issued. We have seen committee members such positive results, and what I mean by that is the terminations are avoided and people remain in their homes. Autonomy choice, just to give you an example of what does that include, we're looking at issues with privacy, retaliation, choice of health care, and other preferences. Quality of care continues to show us areas of falls, accidents, slow response time, personal hygiene. One element that's not on this slide that I want to bring to your attention is the number of withdrawn complaints. So in 2023, there were 1,256. In 2022, 1,432. A contributing factor that we have marked here is why is this happening? So what withdrawn means is a resident is contacting us, they'll hear from us, and they will eventually say, don't worry, no, I don't need your help, and please do not talk to anybody about this concern. The contributing factor is fear of retaliation. Retaliation is real. It is a pervasive problem for many residents. In fact, many residents will either not report at all, withdraw their concern, or plead that their name or anything about them will not be revealed due to fear of retaliation. The gentleman that you saw his picture, he did provide us with consent immediately to share his story, and we appreciate that. But there still is quite an issue with retaliation. So the next slide is where I will begin to talk to you about policy priorities. And the priorities, as I mentioned earlier, are driven from what we see in our complaint investigations and what we are hearing from the people that we represent. Serving people with mental illness and substance use disorder, the resident experience. So facts from the National Association for Mental Illness, or NAMI, at least 20% of adults ages 55 and older experience some mental disorders such as depression, anxiety, or severe cognitive impairment. Approximately 4.8% of adults over 65 have a serious mental illness. People with serious mental illness die 20 to 25 years earlier than their peers due to health conditions, due to understaffing and lack of proper staff training in this area. We are seeing an over-reliance on medications to address these challenges. Example, a man was admitted to an assisted living facility with pre-existing mental illness diagnoses. The facility did not know how to care for the man and would trigger his symptoms through the way staff interacted with him. When the man became agitated, the staff would call 911. Alternatively, the resident's case manager and regional ombudsman were able to easily de-escalate him when he was upset. Both professionals have training in effective de-escalation techniques. When the facility began termination proceedings, they used the 9/11 calls precipitated by staff to justify the resident's termination of contract. Regional ombudsmen across the state have noted through their complaint work and working with residents, many residents are living in secure dementia care units but do not have dementia or dementia-related diagnoses. Most residents living in these locked units do have a pre-existing diagnosis of substance use disorder. Instead of creating and implementing a care plan to support a resident's symptoms, this practice is being used, we believe, to circumvent these residents' civil rights. There is also, as we know, a concern within our country in serving people with these disorders. Five minutes. Yes. I'm really going to have to cut this short. There are other examples on this screen. We'll move to the fact that the Office of Ombudsman, it does have proposed legislation this session regarding training requirements for staff to receive training on mental illness and de-escalation training. I want to talk a bit about people who are living in HUD-exempt facilities. So people in need of and receiving long-term care services and supports living in buildings subsidized by Housing Urban Development, or HUD, are exempted from assisted living licensure. But we know people living in these settings have identical service needs to people living in licensed assisted livings, do not have the same consumer protections, yet they are just as vulnerable as people in assisted living settings. So an example that I will not go into all the detail is about this gentleman who was diagnosed with dementia living in a secured unit. He was in a HUD setting. He was issued a 10-day service termination notice. Services did terminate in 10 days. He was told, you can stay living here, but we're not going to provide you with services. Where that left them was, you go out and find your own services, which is almost impossible to do and to afford. He did have to move. He did move to an assisted living with a dementia care unit. The price went up substantially. The family noted that they were never told at any given time when their father moved into this setting that this was not an assisted living setting that was licensed. Next slide. The topic here is transparency and staffing standards. So, Chair Knorr, at some point, if you ever feel that to bring me back would be very beneficial, I am more than willing to do that because I really feel that this committee needs to hear what is going on within your communities straight from the people that you represent. So in this particular slide, I have no time to go through the detail regarding transparency and staffing standards. The transparency issue is about financial disclosing ownership, disclosing what am I paying for? Many people are coming to us saying, my bill is going up. What am I paying for? It doesn't seem to be reflected in my services. Where is this money going? And so the story that I have here, again, I do not have time to talk about, but in this particular situation, her care was primarily provided by agency or temporary staff. There was much abuse that went on during this time. She did leave, and she's now in a different setting. She recalls the time she spent in the nursing home was so traumatizing. She had frequent thoughts of suicide. There's one last slide, and that is a final recommendation that I thought about when I was ending my, putting together my testimony. And here is where I feel I don't have all the answers, but I do know that there is a need for adequate access to demographic data on people served. There are many agencies, there are many multiple government agencies that have very good data, but there's no real one place that we can all look to in order to capture all of that data to better inform our policy decisions. At this point, though, it's not a negative recommendation. I'm simply stating the fact. I'm not sure if,
Thank you, Ms. Hannon. I think we've got a quick question from Representative Hicks. And
thank you so much, Chair. I will be so fast. I just wanted to say thank you so much for bringing to light the need to make sure that we have de-escalation techniques and training and support for people in our long-term care facilities. People who are in our, who are receiving services in their home and community when they are 20, 30, 40, 50 because of various disabilities like autism or developmental disabilities or other neuro differences become seniors with neuro differences. And the same training that they need, the same training that the supports need when they're 20, 30, 40, don't go away when they're 65. And so I just really appreciate you highlighting that need and wanted to say thank you.
Ms. Hannon?
Chair Nora, Representative Hicks, thank you very much.
Representative McGraw.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I have worked with Ombudsman for much of my career, and they play a great role, and I'm glad to see these maps. I think that as we roll out new training, the nursing homes have always had continuing ed for the CNAs, and there is in statute right now and always has been on dealing with cognitive changes for training. And so it might not be called mental health, but I know in my 30, 40 years, we did a lot of training on continually every month, and it was the same way in the assisted living. So there could be isolated situations, but when you look at these numbers, I think it's important to look at the total, I'd love, you know, the total numbers of quality care complaints or discharge, all these topics in percentage to how many you're serving is also an important statistic to look at. There is also a tremendous amount of people that are having good outcomes, and then we have situations that you're continually working on. But I think perspective is important because these are all reflective to the fact this body controls the money and we have a labor shortage. And so how long people are waiting for a call light to be answered is longer in a hospital, and it's longer in a nursing home, and it's longer in an assisted living. And those expectations right now are very high at a time when we have the greatest workforce. So I think the scope of perspective is really important. I'd like to see a percentage based on the number of people we're serving in these community nursing homes and other versus the complaint in these things. That would be helpful. Thank you.
Ms. Hannon, I think you'll be coming back here to provide us more detail, and welcome Ms. Rudina. So if you can give us your closing remarks, and then we will invite you back so you can explain some of these issues in detail.
Chair Noor, and I also want to thank you, Representative Zelensikar, for your comments. In closing, I appreciate that you said we welcome to bring you back in the future, because we do have more information to share. We might also be able to address things that Representative Zelensikar is referring to. And then I will also invite Chair Noor that if you or your members have questions on anything and want further information, please feel free to provide them to me via my email address.
Well, thank you. We have no further agenda items. With that, we are now adjourned.